Welcome to PwC's Tax Readiness Podcast Series. This podcast is an excerpt from PwC's Tax Readiness webcast held on May 26, 2021, Preparing for Deals in a Changing Environment. In this podcast, the panelists provide a general business overview with respect to deals in the current environment, IPOs and SPACs activity, deals in the current U.S. environment, and other global tax considerations. Have a listen.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our Tax Readiness webcast series. Today, we're going to be discussing preparing for deals in a changing environment. So with that, let me jump into our panel today and introduce them. I am Julie Allen. I am our National Tax Service Market Leader. I am joined today by Craig Gearson, who is a partner in our Mergers and Acquisitions Group, Carrie Parker, who is also a partner in our Mergers and Acquisitions Group, and Thomas Reese, who is a partner in our International Tax Service Group. Our agenda today is we're going to be going over the general business overview that we're seeing with respect to deals in the current environment. Then we will dive deeper into IPOs and SPACs, which are two areas where we are seeing a lot of activity right now. We will then go into deals in the current U.S. tax environment, and we'll finish up with deals in the global tax environment and global considerations that we need to take into account. With that, let me start off with the business overview. As many of you are probably aware, the deals environment right now, we are in a hot deals market. And that is really being driven by large amounts of capital and low interest rates, and then also the interest in deal activity. Some of the factors that are driving a lot of competition in the market are dry capital and then robust fundraising. And those are increasing the competition, which is also directly increasing values and valuations. And what we are seeing is that many companies, in addition to these factors, are looking for ways to create value. I will say it's been different coming through the pandemic. Many of the things that companies were focusing on prior to the pandemic have changed. Not all of them, but some of those priorities or some of those strategies have changed, and they found different ways to create value. And that's also driving some of the activity in the deals market. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the SPAC phenomenon and that we are seeing a lot of activity with respect to SPACs. I'm not going to steal Craig's thunder on this area because he's going to take us through some of those issues that we're seeing and considerations. And in addition to SPACs, also seeing private equity capitalizing on those assets via sales or IPOs are areas where we're seeing a lot of activity. Some of the global considerations that we're seeing, and again, coming out of the pandemic, but I would say even before that time period, are companies really focusing on industry structural shifts and vulnerabilities. We're seeing companies going through their supply chain, deciding what is important to them, where do they need to put more effort or energy into that supply chain, and what areas do they need to pull back on. We're also seeing portfolio reconfigurations, companies looking at what is their core business or what businesses do they want to take forward from this point or what do they want in their portfolio versus those assets that they would divest of. We're also seeing a lot of change in consumer demands and purchasing behaviors. I think many of the items that we saw purchased throughout the pandemic may have been different than what we saw before that, as we all know. And I think even those changes are driving further changes that we're seeing in consumer demand and behavior. And then more complex balance sheets, different strategies that we're seeing with respect to debt or debt holders, different assets that we're seeing used in a compensation or a debt space. I think cryptocurrency might come to mind for many in this area of saying, we're seeing things like digital assets or cryptocurrency being used where before that wasn't something that was playing in. And also many differences just with regular balance sheets and with debt and with the level of debt. I think also through what's driving some of this deal activity and the global considerations is really liquidity management. If we look at what companies were focusing on through the pandemic and through some of the survival that was going on there, you also had liquidity management that they were considering, and cost reduction or strategic portfolio reviews, and looking at what operational strategies they were using and what they needed to turn around and deliver on versus those that they needed to pull back on and pull back on scale and not have those in their portfolio. All of those are considerations that are not only driving what the deal environment is doing in the US, but globally. And then also mergers, acquisitions, and divestitures have been an area that companies have used to really right size and focus on the business that they're going to take coming out of this time period. So those are the real key drivers that we've been seeing with respect to the US deals environment, with respect to the increased valuations, and then some of the global considerations that are being taken into account and to how multinational companies run their business. Craig, I'm going to come over to you if I can. You know, I mentioned in the global deals environment that mergers, acquisitions, and divestitures, we're seeing a lot of activity in this space. And I know that you're going to focus a lot on IPOs and SPACs today. One of the areas that we also see a lot of activity is in joint ventures and using joint ventures in the deal space. And so since we're going to focus more on IPOs and SPACs, will you just take a few minutes and maybe give us some pointers with respect to joint ventures and some of the considerations that we're seeing are some of the key items for our participants to take away?
Yeah, absolutely, Julie. Thanks. So there is a lot of M&A activity generally right now, and not surprisingly, a lot of that activity is happening using partnerships. I think we can probably pin the utility of partnerships in deals on a couple of points, some of which are new and some of which are not so new. First of all, partnerships continue to functionally be a very flexible instrument in terms of structuring deals. Now, using a partnership frequently frees the JV participants from the structural constraints and restrictions that a corporation might place on deal economics. That flexibility also addresses many of the issues that, Julie, you were just speaking to. They're top of mind on the business side as these deals are coming together right now. Will supply chain shift as we move out of the pandemic? Will buying habits change permanently or return to the old normal? The uncertainty around these is causing people to give sort of a fresh look to partnerships as they're structuring their deals and use them in places that they might otherwise not have. That flexibility in structuring deals is also key for another reason right now. And that is because, as we all know, there's a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace right now around tax reform and where things are going. And while we don't know yet what impacts tax reform might have on the partnership rules, we do know that partnerships are malleable enough to be well suited to adapt to whatever changes might be on the horizon. Effectively, partnerships act as a one-way door in tax. It's easy to move from a partnership to a corporation. It's hard to move from a corporate structure to a partnership structure. So as we're looking ahead and we're facing the significant tax uncertainty, we're seeing a lot of people turn to partnerships as sort of the starting point in terms of the best way to deal and try to plan within this area of uncertainty. The last big trend that we're seeing in the M&A space around partnerships leads us right into our next topic. And that is, as you mentioned, Julie, the torrid pace of the IPO market and the emergence of SPACs as significant players in that market. So with that, we will turn to our next topic. This has been a banner year for IPO activity, including Up-C IPOs of companies structured as partnerships. I'm going to very briefly talk about some sort of the moment observations on the IPO market and then offer a sort of a simple primer on the basics of Up-C structuring. So SPACs, or special purpose acquisition companies, are definitely enjoying a moment in the spotlight right now. For those who are unaware of the role of SPACs in the capital markets, they basically take the standard IPO story and they flip that on its head. The traditional IPO story is that of the business that fights and grows until it eventually hits sort of a critical mass. And that allows it to function under the pressures of the public marketplace. And at that point, the company might engage a banker and undergo a public offering. Now, the SPAC flips that story and comes at things from the reverse angle. The SPAC goes out and does a public offering before it even has a business. It raises capital from the public on the promise that it will acquire and grow a suitable business in the future. So public investors put in their money, which goes into a trust, and then SPAC goes out and looks for a company to acquire in whole or in part. From the target operating company's perspective, the big upshot here is expedience. Not surprisingly, going public is a lot of work. The SPAC's effectively done a lot of that heavy lifting by working with investment bankers, getting through the S1 process, and getting listed on an exchange. Although the path for that operating company to merge with a SPAC is by no means simple or fast, it still cuts material time and effort out of the system. The IPO market has been incredibly hot in 2020 and 2021. And this is partially due to the unprecedented degree of SPAC activity. As you can see from this chart, 63 SPAC deals closed last year with a combined value of over $100 billion, a number that we're on pace to easily surpass this year. And remember, when we see all these SPAC IPOs represented by the gray bars on the slide, these are not operating businesses until they close a deal. Each of these represents a suitcase full of cash that's racing around looking for a business to invest in. Now, if you've been keeping an eye on the SPAC market, you know that the SEC did some saber rattling around some of the financial accounting around SPAC warrants. I would say that it slowed the pace of SPAC deals while the financial accountants get that treatment worked out. However, as we see on the next slide, it's also key to remember that there are literally hundreds of these already public SPACs still out there in the marketplace. And the founders of those SPACs only get paid if they close a deal. So I would expect that while the number of SPAC deals might slow in the long term, you should expect a continuing tail in the near term, as all of the SPACs that have already gone public in the past 6 months try to get a deal to close. SPACs that have gone public and are looking to close deals are not concentrated in a single industry. They're not picky. As many as a third have carte blanche to invest in any suitable investment. So it's a good bet that any business that is interested in going public will attract the interest of public SPACs. And the real current development in this area, from my perspective, is the PIPE, or private investment in public equity market. It's very common in these deals for private investors to kind of top off the SPAC proceeds to right-size the deal. My observation is that while the SPAC market is still going strong, the PIPE market has dried up considerably. I think you can likely chalk this up to the fact that PEs and other PIPE investors are recognizing that these SPAC deals are not always exhibiting high immediate returns, and they come at a significant cost because of the economic bites that the SPAC founder takes out of the deal. So as a result, PIPE investors are turning away from that market to a certain extent, and they're looking to either acquire companies directly or make direct investments. That PIPE market is still out there for the SPACs, but it's getting tighter and tighter. This is all sort of a story that's still being written. So, you know, we're continuing to look and see how this plays out in the near term. So knowing that all these SPACs are zipping around looking to close deals, the next logical question is how those deals should be structured, which is where we'll spend the remainder of our time for this topic. The major trend line that we're seeing right now is that if the target company is held in a flow-through form, there are a lot of benefits to undertaking the IPO as an Up-C or as an umbrella partnership corporation. I would say it is the preferred structure right now for eligible private equity portfolio companies and for asset managers that want to access capital markets. The reason that the Up-C is so popular right now is that it's effectively a best of both worlds structure that allows the historical owners of the operating business to continue to enjoy the tax benefits of being in a flow-through company, but simultaneously allows the company to access the capital markets, which requires a corporate entity as the ticket for entrance into those markets. The simple solution is to use two separate entities for these two separate purposes. The business sits in the partnership underneath, same as it always has, while the corporation on top acts as a portal or a window into the capital market. In the structure, the historical owners continue to hold their economic stake directly in the operating partnership, while the SPAC, or the public company, has a proportionate interest in the partnership. Regardless of the economic ownership, the public company will have sole voting control over the operating business, but the direct partner economics are mirrored in vote-only shares of the public company held by the direct partners. The structure provides liquidity by permitting the direct partners to take an economic unit, bundle it with a voting share in the public company, and exchange those rights together for a single publicly traded share of stock. Effectively, the basis of the structure is that every unit in the partnership is the economic equivalent of a share of stock. And so because there is that always that one-for-one ratio between the two, we have free transferability out of partnership units and into shares of public stock. The structure is effectively invisible to the public because the company's financials are going to be consolidated on the books of the public company, or the SPAC, while the other partner's interests are shown as a non-controlling interest, or NCI. None of this is new. While we're seeing a big boom in the use of these structures right now, they've been popular for several decades and extend back even further in the real estate industry with the UPREIT, or umbrella partnership REIT structure that applied identical mechanics in the REIT market. So as shown on the next slide, tax efficiency is one of the twin catalysts for use of the UPC structure in the marketplace. The other catalyst is that's really driving these deals right now is the availability of a tax receivable agreement, or a TRA. A TRA is basically a tax sharing agreement in which one person agrees to refund an agreed upon portion of actual tax savings that results from the tax attributes delivered within a structure. Although the refund percentage is open for negotiation, UPC IPOs and SPAC UPCs have almost without fail settled on 85% as the amount of the tax savings that get paid across to the original owners. And while this might sound like a small slice of the deal, it's actually quite material. It's not uncommon for the TRA to increase proceeds to the sellers by as much as 30% over time at current tax rates. And this can translate into hundreds of millions of dollars in a lot of IPO deals. This does get paid out over time as the tax attributes are recovered, most frequently over about 15 years. But a large sum, even paid over 15 years, is still a large sum in net present value terms. And by the way, if corporate tax rates go up, then that supplemental TRA return will go up as well. So if you're not familiar with TRAs, you may be asking, why does this all work? How has it become a significant part of these deals? And the next slide describes sort of what I would say is the key to the TRA, which is that markets tend not to view tax as a meaningful indicator of a company's performance. Instead, they tend to focus on pre-tax metrics like EBITDA. So despite a company posting a very large TRA obligation on its balance sheet, investors see a slightly larger deferred tax asset, an EBITDA number that is not impacted at all, and generally seem to shrug at them. The message that is continually expressed by both analysts and bankers is that the trading price of the stock is not affected by the existence of the TRA. And as long as that continues to be true, we'll expect to see TRAs be a significant value driver in the assembly of IPO deals. And really, this shouldn't be a surprise. This is not much different than any buyer paying a premium in what is effectively an asset purchase as compared to what they would pay in a stock acquisition. Now, because the TRA is a negotiated agreement and because it's not driven by the tax rules themselves, instead is simply driven by the marketplace and what bankers and analysts perceive the market will accept and agree to, we do see variability in trend lines in the terms that we see in tax receivable agreements. And it's important to keep track of those, as staying current on the TRA terms can both drive good press for deals and ensure that that the sellers receive full value for the TRA component of the deal that they negotiate. So some of the top trend lines that we're seeing right now include, number one, a willingness to expand the tax attributes that are covered by the TRA. We're seeing increasing numbers of TRAs that pay for tax basis that's already inherent on the tax balance sheet, in addition to the step up on the effective purchase of the assets that's sort of always been the core component of these TRAs. We're also seeing TRAs that look increasingly to NOLs of corporations that merge into the public company. And given the new rules limiting the availability of interest deductions, we're increasingly seeing TRAs that cover those increases in the availability of those deductions as a result of the structure. It's not uncommon also to look to impacts on U.S. tax of certain cross-border planning, such as GILTI, or other foreign tax considerations that reverberate back into the U.S., and where the structure might reduce those due to the step up in the assets. Again, it's not uncommon that we would see that covered by the TRA. Other trend lines that we're seeing with increased focus are an increased focus on minimizing the administration costs and hassles of the TRA. Historic owners love TRAs because they provide a lot of additional value and benefit. Companies love them less because they are a lot of work to maintain and implement. And one of the things that we see more and more is a look to try to find some happy medium there so that the company is not bearing all the headache and burden of tracking and doing this administration, and instead, where it makes sense, restrictions are being placed to make that burden more easier. And I would say for anyone who's going through this type of structure, that's a worthwhile thing to consider front of mind and look into. The last thing I'll note here in terms of trend lines is that you would logically ask whether a SPAC, which has a controlling member in the SPAC founder, would look to the same TRA terms as a non-SPAC of CIPO when they're putting that TRA together. And I will tell you that across the board, we do see SPACs tend to adopt the same terms for the TRA that a traditional IPO would have. And when you think about it, that makes sense, right? The SPACs are incentivized to try to close deals on a timely basis. And in a lot of ways, the SPAC's biggest competitor is the simple IPO of the company. The company can simply go forward and IPO on its own. It doesn't need to take the SPAC's money. It's simply a simplifying mechanic. And so for those reasons, I would say, regardless of whether a company is doing an IPO or a de-SPAC transaction, you should expect and generally to see similar terms around the IPO.
Thanks, Craig. And I think your overview there, that was very helpful on unpacking SPACs, IPOs, de-SPACs, and also tax receivable agreements. Because I think many times those get put into one bubble. And I think you appropriately noted when they might each play together or separately, and also highlighted some of those real meaningful indicators of performance and those points to consider when you're looking at a TRA from the perspective of the companies also. Carrie, can I come over to you? And will you give us a peek into how tax considerations in deals, how those have been evolving over the past several months?
Sure, Julie. Hi. I tell you, it's been quite an interesting time to be a tax professional working in the deals environment. If you think about what we've been doing for due diligence over the past couple of years, we've been looking backwards into tax years where companies are just adopting the latest tax reform in the tax regime at a time when guidance is still being issued by service in the Treasury. And so it's been a really interesting time to be getting used to a new tax regime and reporting a new tax regime, and then moving into a pandemic, which of course creates significant changes and disruptions in business that create its own set of tax issues or opportunities, and of course generated its own set of stimulus provisions. And as you mentioned, we're in a really hot deal environment. And to add to all the factors that you mentioned that's creating that really hot deal environment, we also see the potential for tax rate increases also driving that increased volume in people trying to get deals done before tax rates could increase.
Thanks, Carrie. I think you highlighting during that pandemic, not only have we had changes there, but additional ones that we're expecting, you know, that will come down the pike are, is a very important point to note. But Carrie, let's pivot for just a minute. We've gone over now what we're really seeing in the hot deal market and with the, you know, IPOs and with SPACs. Let's now pivot and go to deals in the current U.S. tax environment and additional considerations to take into account. I would say just generally in all of our deals, not necessarily so focused on the public or the IPO deals. So I'll kick it over to you to take us through deals in the current U.S. environment.
Sure. So I thought I would start off with just a little bit on kind of the pandemic influence on tax due diligence and how that has created those incremental risk or opportunities that we have to get comfortable with when we are helping companies, you know, do diligence and think about how an acquisition might fit within their structure. I mentioned earlier the significant business disruptions and changes, and with those, we've seen it, and it's in the Wall Street Journal almost every day, right? Discussions of remote workforce. And the question there is, has that remote workforce changed your tax footprint? And it could be for the better or for the worse. If you think about it domestically, as people have moved from urban environments that are typically higher taxed areas into lower taxed areas, perhaps that gives you a better state footprint. But at the same time, there might be state payroll tax withholding exposures that you're not on top of because of the remote workforce. And so we spend time with clients and with companies thinking about that. The second is supply chain changes, whether that's been, you know, permanent and something that a client has done from a position of strength in the pandemic, or whether they've been forced to do that. And have they aligned their transfer pricing policies to changes in the supply chain? Again, potentially some risk, but also potentially some opportunities. And of course, we're getting into those stimulus pieces of the CARES Act as it relates to tax. Going back to that employee concept there, the employee retention credits, and making sure that if companies have taken advantage of those employee retention credits, that they're there, that they have the right documentation in order to sustain those. If people have taken advantage of the payroll tax deferral, making sure you understand what that cash flow looks like and when that comes due, and that you're prepared for that. Some benefits, the enhanced temporary 163J benefit, have companies taking that into account properly? Have they taken it into account to the fullest extent? And then the NOL carrybacks have been quite interesting. In a period where we're carrying back 5 years over a number of years where a company may have been highly acquisitive, the tax technical rules can create some really interesting results, particularly combined with contractual agreements that companies have entered into as they've sold and bought companies. And so you might be surprised as to who's really entitled to that cash refund at the end of the day. And so we spend a lot of time looking at that as well. So pivoting a little bit to just changes, right? We talked about we're just still kind of absorbing that TCJA impact from years 2018 and forward. And we need to be mindful of some of the changes that are coming along with that, and thinking about how that changes the way that you might think about after-tax cash flow in your deal models. And so the first one I want to highlight is the NOL carry-forward limitation. It came out of the TCJA. It was kind of suspended for a couple of years as a result of the CARES Act, but we have this 80% limitation usage of NOL carry-forwards for those NOLs that were generated post-tax reform. And so as companies start to utilize those this year and going forward, that 80% limitation can have the impact of creating effectively a minimum tax that we haven't seen for a few years. Of course, there's always the popular discussion on Section 163J, where we've been living with a limit based on tax EBITDA, if you will, and before depreciation and amortization. And of course, people are very nervous about the change that is set to occur starting next year, where that 163J limit goes down to EBIT. And that's particularly troublesome and worries those companies that have been acquisitive in the past in asset acquisitions, or companies that have made investments, you know, in capital intensive investments. Similar to that, the full expensing, the 100% expensing on PP&E, that 100% deduction on qualifying assets starts to ratchet down on an annual basis starting in 2023. So it's not a 100% limit, it's an 80% limit in 2023 and so on and so forth. And of course, the R&E and internally developed software, where we've seen immediate benefit for the past several years, and now we're looking at a capitalization and amortization over a minimum of 5 years. And so when you think about the changes that these provisions can have, really need to be focused on making sure that deal models, particularly where they are putting a lot of value on capturing tax benefits associated with the deal, or really trying to peg that after-tax cash flow, that these items are really captured in that deal model. So let's go from that to pivot to the current tax proposals. As I mentioned, you know, we saw a frenzy of deals, not only from favorable economic environment, but that potential for tax rates to increase. And we certainly saw that at a level that was a bit surprising in the midst of a pandemic in the fall, people trying to get deals done with a concern that tax rates might go up this year. Of course, now that we've had the election and we have the new administration, and we're talking about tax reform proposals this year, people are continuing to think about trying to adjust their deal plans and their deal models for that potential increase in tax rates. So I thought I would highlight just some key provisions. Of course, there are a lot of different provisions, but the ones that are really driving discussions on how and when deals get done. So the first one is obviously the corporate tax rate. President Biden's Made in America tax plan increases that corporate tax rate to 28%. And there's also a minimum book tax on very large corporations. The individual tax rates, that's particularly interesting in the middle market deal space, in the middle market private equity space, where you have individuals that could potentially see an increase back to that original 39.6% rate that we had pre-TCJA. But more importantly, and I think what drives a lot of deal activity, is the potential for capital gains and qualified dividend income to be taxed at those ordinary rates for high net worth individuals. As it relates to the U.S. multinational provisions that we've been living with since the TCJA, GILTI, and some of those other provisions, the proposals end up at a, you know, the end result is that it's a higher effective rate on that GILTI income. If you go to the next slide, you'll see, again, a lower benefit and repealing that FDII benefit and coming up with a replacement for the BEAT regime. And so, again, the theme of the tax plan as it relates to the potential tax increase in tax rate is really increasing the tax burden of the high net worth individuals and corporations. So how does all that work, and how does that fit in with how you think about a deal? So when you're diligencing and when you're modeling out the impact of acquisitions, you really must take into account the future reduction in benefits of all those things we've talked about, whether it's because of just the way the TCJA starts to tail off on benefits as it was written, or whether it is the potential increase in tax rates and the implementation of a new tax regime by the current administration. So you really should make sure that you're modeling and perhaps even thinking about different scenarios. You see in the press, you know, whether people think 28% is the rate or maybe it's 25% when everything gets negotiated. So you definitely want to think about different scenarios. Timing of deal closing, we are living and breathing this right now. Sellers that didn't get their deal done in 2020 because of a potential increase in tax rates this year certainly are going to be looking to do that in 2021 with the potential tax rate increase for 2022. Something else that we saw when tax rates increased, when the Bush tax cuts expired during the Obama administration about a decade ago, we also saw sellers triggering 100% of their built-in gain, even when they are retaining interest, to again, trigger that at a lower rate, looking forward into a potential higher rate environment. For deals closing in 2022, it's an interesting thing to deal with, but sellers may consider triggering some of the gain in 2021, as they think about a very large disposition, perhaps a carve out of a business that's going to take some packaging and restructuring in order to convey that business to a buyer. Sellers may think about triggering that gain at lower tax rates in 2021. Of course, you have to be very careful. You don't want to trigger gain on a deal that you may never do. So it is a tricky proposition to think about, but we know that companies are out there thinking about those things. One of the benefits of the potential higher tax rates for buyers is that the corporate or the gross ups on transactions where there's incremental tax costs in order to get an asset basis step up for buyers, those costs may be less when you do your net present value calculation of how much do I have to pay the taxpayer or the seller to make them whole versus what is my future recovery. That future recovery at higher rates could result in a lower NPV on the gross up today. So it's definitely something to think about. And of course, it's very fact specific based on your recovery period, particularly if you have shorter lived assets and your discount rate. When you think about using attributes, as I mentioned, some taxpayers may be thinking about trying to accelerate some of the gain associated with the deal, and that would certainly make sense if they have attributes that would otherwise expire unutilized, whether those are perhaps NOLs or expiring capital losses or excess GILTI foreign tax credits that expire every year like we see with most multinational companies. Sellers may also want to preserve built-in losses for higher rate tax year. So if they're doing a transaction that might preserve their current built-in loss because it's a tax deferred transaction, they may want to do that instead of trying to trigger a loss today. When we saw the TCJA coming, a lot of people did installment sell notes because when you recognize gain on an installment sale, it's taxed at the tax rate in the year in which the installment sale gain is recognized. So some people took installment sale notes before tax reform with the hope that the gain would then be recognized at a lower tax rate. If people may be thinking, well, now those tax rates are going up, and so perhaps I want to trigger that installment sale gain today. And the last point is buyers may value step-ups more in a higher rate environment. Your after-tax cash flows are obviously helped to the extent that you can get that cost recovery, whether it's depreciation or amortization, at a higher effective tax rate. The last thing I would mention on accounting methods, when you think about accounting methods and when you're doing diligence and trying to understand the accounting methods, when you're in a rate change environment, you could be on the good side of things or you could be on the bad side of things. And so I think you want to make sure that you're not surprised about the accounting methods, and because it's not just a timing item where those timing items shift across different rates. So Julie, hopefully that helped. Just a very, very high level summary. I could go on, as you can imagine, forever on all of the things that we see. I think the takeaway is being really, really focused and staying up to date on all of these various provisions and modeling them out. Everything is very fact specific. I have multiple companies now that are starting to consider dispositions, and each of them have different fact patterns. And it really requires digging into the specific facts, modeling out all the scenarios.
Carrie, thank you so much, because I think just as Craig unpacked all the parts of some of those buzzwords that you hear on IPOs, SPAC, DSPAC, TRAs, just as he unpacked all of that, I think you appropriately unpacked some of the points that we need to think about in a deals environment, and just practical and tactical considerations to run through when you're thinking of your modeling. I want to highlight a couple of the points that you said, where you said it's about tax technical, but it's also about contractual agreements and looking at those. I think that was key. I think also your point on modeling, and then your point on attributes. We heard that in Craig's part with the tax receivable agreements, and also here in the modeling that you're highlighting, that attributes are really important and are a thing to really focus on. And they're something that we really look at in the deals environment. So I think both of you highlighting that was key. And Thomas, can I come over to you? You know, we've spent time here on the public market, as Craig highlighted, IPOs, SPACs, and PIPEs. We're now, and then Carrie took it even further to the US deals market and things that we should think about, whether it's, you know, a restructuring that you're doing or a current deal. So we would be remiss if we then didn't come over and look at the global deals environment. So having looked at all of this US environment information, can you give us some quick insights into what's happening in the global deals environment? Then I'll come back in and summarize polling question three, and then we'll kick it over to you to really dive deeper in that global environment.
Certainly, happy to, Julie. And I think it's a recurring theme, really similar to the message that Carrie had, which is, you know, you might be excused for thinking there's been a significant amount of change already in the international tax environment. So surely we're in for a period of stability, in particular in light of all of the change that's happened as a result of the OECD BEPS action items. But I think, unfortunately, the message is, I'm afraid not. We have the OECD Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 sort of hanging over us, with an update due in the summer as to some fairly fundamental change in the international environment. And even notwithstanding that, we've already seen a number of territories introducing digital service taxes to deal with the digital economy. And on top of that, you have a number of issues where governments are going to have to deal with the significant amount of COVID-19 relief measures that have been in place, and therefore look to either increasing tax rates or broadening the tax base. And I think that will likely also lead to increases in tax audit and controversy. And so I think all of those things really lead to a landscape of, you know, significant continued change for business to try to stay on top of, all of which is relevant in the context of either a diligence environment or how you want to structure the deal.
Yeah, very key points to note. I mean, digital services taxes, we've got some podcasts that we've done on those also, right? That's a hot item. And then I just think your point of looking at what you're doing in that global environment, but also considering the audit side of it or the risk related to with anything, you know, any transaction or anything that you're doing is very key. So with that, let's turn to you for the last section. And will you take us through, knowing their responses there, are some of the global deals things, that items that we need to consider in the deals environment?
Yeah, certainly. Thanks, Julie. So I think the first thing really that we see in the deals environment is as part of a deal structuring transaction, how do you want to structure that from a financing perspective? And there are a number of key components here when we're considering this in a global context. And that's really in light of a continued challenge around ability to obtain effective tax relief for debt finance costs. And that's being driven by a number of international tax provisions in jurisdictions that restrict interest. So that might be purpose-based provisions, looking at why a company has borrowed debt. It might be anti-hybrid provisions, which have become significantly more important in the last 2 years. Or it might just be similar to the discussion around the 163J rules, interest caps or limitations based on some sort of portion of EBITDA, which are very common as a consequence of the BEPS action item 4. And when you look at any particular deal, you really need to look at the territories that you're acquiring and consider what are the local rules, and therefore how do you best want to structure that deal in order to achieve your efficient structure. So for example, if you take purpose-based tests and territories that have those, a deal transaction is often the best time to be able to look at introducing debt into a territory. And that might lead itself to, say, more piecemeal type acquisitions as opposed to single transactions. But you have to combine all of your territories in one picture here to put the whole package together in terms of deal structuring. We also see a number of considerations around whether to put external debt into local jurisdiction markets or whether to utilize an intragroup financing company. And it's fair to say it's still very common to utilize a finance company for a number of reasons. But in doing so, you have to have regard to anti-hybrid rules that have been introduced globally, but in particular in the EU, and in particular in the EU in response to the ATAD 2 directive, which required that all EU member states have hybrid rules in effect from 1 January 2020. Now, this is an area that causes a lot of challenge for business, because whilst there's a common directive that was required to be introduced, every jurisdiction has introduced that in a slightly different way. And there's often limited guidance and practical application as to how to apply these rules. And so it's very difficult to say there's a one size fits all answer. So if you take, for example, Spain and Germany, they've only really just introduced their final legislation. And so it's very difficult for clients to, for businesses to have certainty in relation to the application of those rules. So if I talk to a number of my international partners, for example, we get different interpretations by jurisdiction on where you might end up with an interest disallowance where you're borrowing from a particular financing company as compared to another. And so again, I think that points to needing to look at this sort of on a deal-specific basis. It would be remiss of me to talk about financing companies without having some regard to the longevity of a structure, and in particular, the potential application of Pillar 2 to the extent that there's an agreement reached there, in relation to the fact that that's currently proposed to include a subject to tax test, which would apply first in preference to a number of the other rules. So again, there are a number of aspects to consider from a future perspective. Lastly, I touched on benefits of financing companies. One of the other things in the deal structuring environment that we very commonly see is the ability to use a financing company to assist you in both book and tax foreign exchange management. And that's often very beneficial because it allows treasury teams to look at raising debt in a territory that they want or in a currency mix that they want, but to still enable an efficient foreign exchange structure. If I move then on to the next slide and give some thought to cash repatriation, which is another area that we're seeing a continued challenge for business in a deals environment. And this is really in light of substance and purpose-based challenges in relation to holding company structures. So the recent EU Danish beneficial ownership cases have given rise to a number of EU territories raising cases as to whether holding companies are really the beneficial owners of dividend income, and therefore whether they're really entitled to withholding tax exemptions either domestically under a treaty or under an EU directive. Similarly, the principal purpose test that's been introduced in a number of treaties as a consequence of as a consequence of the multilateral instrument has also meant an increased pressure as to sustaining why holding companies have been introduced and ensuring that you have contemporaneous documentation. And I think all of those things are putting increased pressure on having flatter holding company structures as compared to maybe previously multi-tiered holding company structures, where you only have a certain amount of substance and you really want to look at centralizing that substance in your holding company and also looking at utilizing operational substance. And lastly, just on this slide, in light of all of that challenge, we're seeing an increased focus around looking at other ways to repatriate cash post-deal. So either repayments of debt, if you've managed to align debt into local markets, management charges, or maybe other transactions like share buybacks that work in particular jurisdictions as well. So then my last slide, I think Julie picks up some of the other items that maybe came out of our polling question there in relation to post-acquisition restructuring and some of the components we're seeing. And again, picking up some of the points that Karen made around, you know, that the last 12, 18 months has really shown us there's a significantly evolving environment around how businesses are operating, where synergies can be created, you know, what supply chains look like. And all of those things are pointing to post-deal restructuring around centralization of value drivers and functions. And they clearly have transfer pricing considerations, but also considerations around exit taxes. And all of these need to be considered really as part of your deal restructuring to know how you want to plan for the future. A word of caution, though, in respect of any post-deal restructuring, you'll hopefully have already thought about indirect transfer taxes as part of the deal. But there are a number of traps for the unwary in relation to non-resident transfer taxes and indirect transfer taxes that might be triggered on post-acquisition structuring. So, for example, transfers of IP or patents, for example, that are in the UK or Germany, can trigger taxation even when transferred between two non-resident entities. So you really want to be careful and think around how do you want to structure post-deal, as I say, when you're doing the deal planning. And then lastly, again, similar to some of Carrie's points around tax attributes, you know, we see in a number of jurisdictions particular rules to be careful of around protecting tax attributes, be that NOLs or interest carry forwards, and thinking about how you best monetize those, perhaps maybe against exit taxes or the like. So lots of food for thought there, hopefully, for people, but a lot to think about in terms of deal structuring.
Thomas, thank you. I think that completes the picture, right, where we talk about our IPOs and SPACs and our U.S. deals market and then you completing it with global. I think some of the things that you highlighted, almost every deal we're seeing, yes, you have U.S. components, but also foreign components. And so thinking through your holding company structure, thinking through some of those additional rules and then highlighting the indirect taxes and attributes, I think was really key. That we're looking at that from a global level. What I would like to do is come back to the panelists and maybe in, you know, 30 or 40 seconds each, if you all would give us your key takeaways to summarize all the excellent information that we've conveyed today. And let's start off, Craig, I'll start with you. And then Carrie, if you'll just go right after Craig, and Thomas, jump in right after Carrie.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. I think I would just be brief and say the IPO market is hot. The capital markets are hot. There for people who are looking for cash to do for whatever purpose, there are a lot of opportunities out there, and it's kind of a seller's market. And so while UPSEs and IPOs are sort of at the top of the list, it's a great opportunity for companies to assess their balance sheet and think about whether they need to add anything.
Yeah, from my perspective, I think staying close to the developments and thought leadership around the potential tax reform is very key, particularly for tax people. Be informed, have a point of view, and help your C-suite avoid surprises and perhaps actually add value.
Yeah, and for me, it would be, you know, there are so many different components from a global tax perspective to consider that you might want to do in a post-deal restructuring environment. But often it's really critical to know what you want to do post deal when you're shaping the deal transaction, because it might shape how you want to do that. So really think about what you want your future to look like in the context of your deal planning and bake that into your structuring at the time.
Thank you all, Craig, Carrie, and Thomas. Thank you for joining us today and for your insight on this panel. And then thank you to all of the participants for joining us, and have a great day, everybody.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.